Today is Thursday, November 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, after a second full day of impeachment testimony, Washington is in its third as the Democrat-led House of Representatives Intelligence Committee hears from two more witnesses.
I want nothing. I want nothing. I want no quid pro quo.
The president continues any wrongdoing. Plus, we'll have a recap of last night's presidential candidate debate, and brush fires in Australia continue to spread. Those stories and more are next. U.S. diplomat Gordon Sondland told the impeachment panel investigating President Donald Trump Wednesday that despite the president's denial, U.S. aid to Ukraine was conditional on investigations benefiting Trump's personal political interests. Sondland's testimony could mark a pivotal turning point in the impeachment inquiry in the U.S. House of Representatives. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports from Capitol Hill on the explosive testimony that could impact Trump's future in office.
The U.S. ambassador to the EU testifying in public for the first time about the link between American military aid to Ukraine and investigations that would benefit President Trump politically.
I know that members of this committee frequently frame these complicated issues in the form of a simple question. Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes.
Sondland explaining he, Ambassador Kurt Volker, and Energy Secretary Rick Perry acted under the direction of Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani.
We all understood that if we refused to work with Mr. Giuliani, we would lose a very important opportunity to cement relations between the United States and Ukraine. So we followed the president's orders.
On the 26th.
House Democrats said Sondland's testimony clearly established Trump abused the power of his office.
We also have heard for the first time that knowledge of this scheme was pervasive. The Secretary of State was aware of it. The acting chief of staff Mulvaney was aware of it. And of course, at the very top, Donald Trump, through his personal lawyer and others, was implementing it.
Well,
Sondland leveled serious allegations against top administration officials, including Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who defended his role.
I know precisely what American policy was with respect to Ukraine. I was working on it, and I'm incredibly proud of what we've accomplished. We delivered remarkable outcomes for the Ukrainian people.
Trump defended himself by quoting his own phone conversation earlier this year with Sondland.
I want nothing. I want nothing. I want no quid pro quo. Tell Zelensky, President Zelensky, to do the right thing. This is the final word from the President of the United States. I want nothing.
Trump released close to $400 million in U.S. military aid to Ukraine on September 11th. After concerns about the holdup became public. Republicans argue Trump cannot be impeached if the aid was released and Ukraine never announced the investigations.
They get the call, they get the meeting, they get the money.
A Republican argument that appears to be holding his base of supporters, says one analyst.
His base is sticking with him. We have seen some Republicans outspoken who have come out and been critical of him or who have suggested that maybe this was inappropriate. But those critiques haven't been particularly harsh or sustained. They haven't sort of created an infectious kind of wave of not backing the president.
Support in the Republican majority U.S. Senate will be key to keeping Trump in office if he faces a trial there, following a vote on articles of impeachment in the Democratic-controlled U.S. House of Representatives.
And joining us now on the phone from Capitol Hill is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
So, Catherine, we had two more witnesses today, followed by several more this week. What can you give us as far as the attitude and the feeling in the House during this intense week of impeachment hearings?
Very intense week. You know, we had 8 to 9 witnesses
all crowded together in the space of 3 days. So there's a massive information that we're learning more and more about what exactly was happening within the Trump administration in relation to congressionally approved U.S. aid to Ukraine. That said, it doesn't mean that I think anybody's minds have been changed by this testimony. We're really dug in here on both sides of the aisle, Democratic and Republican, in the ways each party perceives what the president did or did not do.
In general terms, the testimony with Fiona Hill and Mr. Holmes is still ongoing today. But looking at their opening statements and what has been shared so far, what has been the Democratic and Republican takes on their testimony?
Right. So we had testimony from Hale, who is really talking about this restaurant phone conversation that he overheard from President Trump discussing, quote, investigations. So we're getting into this really interesting area with Republicans who are saying, you know, look, Democrats are really scraping the bottom of the barrel here. They're, you know, trying to get this phone conversation and talking about overheard phone calls, all of that. They're saying the Democrats are desperate and that this is proof because of the testimony today. Fiona Hill has been really interesting because she has been very forceful about this idea that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election. She is making the point that that is Russian propaganda that is trying to divert attention from Russia's own efforts to undermine American democracy. As we can remember, U.S. intelligence agencies found and confirmed that Russia did interfere in the 2016 election here in the United States.
So we have about 40 seconds left. This is the last of the scheduled hearings thus far. Next week is Thanksgiving. What's going to take place next?
Well, we actually heard from Nancy Pelosi today, and she was reluctant to say whether or not there would be a vote on articles of impeachment. As she always does, she says that is up to the committees of jurisdiction here in the House of Representatives. So what will likely happen next is that the House Intelligence Committee will refer this matter to the House Judiciary Committee, which traditionally drafts articles of impeachment. If that were to happen, we would see that in the first week of December.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent, speaking to us on the phone from Capitol Hill. Thank you very much for joining us on this Thursday.
You're so welcome.
The 2020 U.S. presidential election was back in the spotlight Wednesday in Atlanta, Georgia, where Democratic presidential contenders gathered for their fifth debate of the primary season. As VOA national correspondent Jim Malone reports from Washington, the impeachment inquiry targeting U.S. President Donald Trump was a key focus of the debate.
There were 10 Democrats on stage in Atlanta for the debate sponsored by MSNBC and The Washington Post. All the candidates support the impeachment inquiry now underway in the House, including former Vice President Joe Biden.
Who is most likely to be able to win the nomination in the first place, to win the presidency in the first place? And secondly, who is most likely to increase the number of people who are Democrats in the House and in the Senate?
Biden is one of the frontrunners in the crowded Democratic field, as is Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
We have to establish the principle no one is above the law. We have a constitutional responsibility, and we need to meet it.
Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar supports the impeachment inquiry, but she will also be a juror if there's a trial in the Senate.
What this impeachment proceeding about is really our democracy at stake.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders warned Democrats about focusing too much on Trump.
He is likely the most corrupt president in the modern history of America. But we cannot simply be consumed by Donald Trump. Because if we are, you know what? We're going to lose the election.
Also weighing in was South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Buttigieg has soared into the lead in recent polls in the early voting states of Iowa and New Hampshire.
We are absolutely going to confront this president for his wrongdoing, but we are also each running to be the president who will lead this country after the Trump presidency comes to an end, one way or the other.
California Senator Kamala Harris said she sees a broader theme at work in the Trump impeachment hearings.
There are clearly two different set of rules for two different groups of people in America. The powerful people who, with their arrogance, think they can get away with this, and then everybody else.
Democrats also clashed over competing health care reform proposals, which has become a clear divide between liberals like Warren and Sanders and moderates like Biden, Buttigieg, and Klobuchar. Democrats hold their next debate in December in Los Angeles. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
On January 14, 2019, NASA's Neil Gehrels Swift Observatory and the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope detected an incredibly powerful explosion in a galaxy some 7 billion light-years away. The explosion was identified as a gamma ray burst. More than 300 astronomers analyzed burst and afterglow data from the two space telescopes, as well as multiple ground-based telescopes, and found that the January 2019 gamma ray burst broke the record for the source of high-energy light in the universe. It's thought that these short but powerful gamma ray bursts can generate as much energy in just a few seconds as our sun will throughout its entire 10 billion year lifetime. The astronomers detailed their discovery and findings in several studies that were recently published in the journal Nature. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. At least four people were killed and 44 wounded early Thursday when Iraqi security forces fired guns and tear gas at protesters near two key bridges in Baghdad. Sources speaking to Reuters News said the cause of death was live fire and tear gas canisters aimed directly at their heads. VOA's Jeff Custer has more.
Police said earlier one protester was killed near the Sinak Bridge and one near the adjacent Arar Bridge. Two other protesters died later in the hospital. One had suffered a gunshot wound to the head and the other was struck in the head by a tear gas canister. Hospital sources said some of the wounded protesters had injuries sustained from live gun rounds. Others were hit by rubber bullets and tear gas canisters. Protesters are still holding ground. They control parts of three major bridges in central Baghdad, which lead to the Baghdad's fortified green zone, where government buildings and foreign embassies are located. More than 300 people have been killed since the start of mass unrest in Baghdad and southern Iraq in early October, the largest demonstration since the fall of Saddam Hussein in 2003. Deadly use of live ammunition, tear gas, and stun grenades against mostly unarmed demonstrators have stoked the unrest. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Israel's attorney general on Thursday formally charged Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a series of corruption cases, throwing the country's paralyzed political system into further disarray and threatening the longtime leader's grip on power. Attorney General Avichai Mandelbit charged Netanyahu with fraud, breach of trust, and accepting bribes in three different scandals. It's the first time a sitting Israeli prime minister has been charged with a crime. Mandelbit was set to issue a formal statement later on Thursday. Allegations against Netanyahu include suspicions he accepted hundreds of thousands of dollars in champagne and cigars from billionaire friends, offered to trade favors with a newspaper publisher, and used his influence to help a wealthy telecom magnate in exchange for favorable coverage on popular news sites. The indictment does not require Netanyahu to resign, but is expected to raise pressure on him to do so. Netanyahu has called the allegations part of a witch hunt. Israeli President Reuven Rivlin informed Parliament that because neither Prime Minister Netanyahu or his chief challenger Benny Gantz have followed his mandate to build a coalition government in the time allotted to them, the process now goes back to the Knesset and kicks off a 21-day window before new elections must be called. Meanwhile, violence in Israeli Arab communities is growing. 79 people have been murdered so far this year. In some areas, parents are afraid to let their children out of their homes in the evening. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli Arab politicians set up a protest tent near the Israeli parliament in Jerusalem and held a three-day hunger strike to protest the violence plaguing their community. Arab lawmaker Aida Tuma Suleiman said they are fed up.
Well, having 79 murders in our society, having every night people shot, groups of organized crimes are terrorizing people every day, terrorizing places of work. They are getting protection. They are giving loans and terrorizing people. We had enough. That's it. We had enough.
Criminal gangs in Arab cities have taken over the streets, brandishing guns and opening fire. The violence has become so endemic that it is being reported on Israel TV. The Israeli government and police department have launched a program to track down illegal weapons and to waive penalties for those who turn them in. But the leader of the Arab Joint List Party in the Knesset, Ayman Odeh, demands that the government do more to crack down on violence.
We need to deal with gangs of organized crime, the black market, and unlicensed weapons. The government is the address. The government knows how to do it, and it succeeded in other areas of Israel.
Some of the Arab community's protest campaigns target so-called honor killings, in which women are murdered by family members on suspicion of improper sexual behavior. The Arab politicians' protest tent was visited by supportive Jewish allies like Rabbi Ehud Bendel from Rabbis for Human Rights.
The blood of Jewish citizens of Israel is not redder than the blood of the Arab citizens of Israel. We are all equal, and it's about time that the Israeli government and the Israeli police will treat us as equals and will deal with violence within the Arab sector.
The Arab community claims that if Jewish citizens were being killed by violence, the police would do more. They say they deserve to live in safety. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
World shares dropped Thursday as anxiety mounted over the possibility of the U.S. and China may not reach a trade deal before next year. China's Commerce Ministry batted away rumors that the talks were in trouble, with a spokesman saying Beijing was committed to continuing discussions on core concerns. Several reports suggested the U.S. and China are struggling to reach a preliminary Phase 1 trade pact that may not be accomplished this year. Investors have been hoping the world's two biggest economies can reach a deal before new and more damaging U.S. tariffs take effect on December 15th on about $160 billion in Chinese imports. The head of the U.N. nuclear watchdog agency says Iran has not provided additional details about the discovery of uranium particles of man-made origin at a location that had not been declared. Cornell Ferruta, the acting director of the IAEA, reported to member states 2 weeks ago that his inspectors had confirmed traces of uranium at a location in Iran not declared to the agency, which appeared to confirm allegations made by the U.S. and Israel about a secret nuclear warehouse. Ferruta says it is essential that Iran works with the agency to resolve this matter promptly. Britain's main opposition Labour Party launched its detailed platform for Britain's December 12th election Thursday as it tried to close an opinion poll gap with the governing Conservatives. The left-to-centre party is pledging higher public spending and a greater role for the state in housing, transport and provision of utilities. Labour, which has been in opposition since 2010, has shifted sharply to the left under leader Jeremy Corbyn after the centrist New Labour years of former Prime Ministers Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. Thousands of people in Bangkok fled to its national sports stadium for Pope Francis's first public mass in Thailand. Francis was circling around the stadium in his Pope Mobile Thursday as the crowd waved yellow and white Holy See flags and chanted Via il Papa. The mass capped a busy first day for the Pope in Asia. It included separate meetings with Thailand's Prime Minister, Supreme Buddhist Leader, and recently crowned King. But Thais weren't the only ones clamoring to see Pope Francis. Ryan Akiza traveled some 2,000 kilometers for the event.
I came from the Philippines, and I came here to Thailand to see the Pope. I actually grew up in a Catholic family, so it's really a big thing seeing the Pope in person. Well, I really hope I can see the Pope from where I sit here. So it's an amazing feeling. I feel very blessed that joining the 0.5% of the population of Thailand, Catholic Thailand, to join the celebration and personally seeing the Pope.
Throughout his stay, Francis has been accompanied by Sister Ana Rosa Sivori, a nun who is his second cousin and is serving as his interpreter. By all indications, she is also serving as counselor. She has joined him in the car for his appointments, taking the usual place of the archbishop. It's a rare case of the Pope consulting with a woman for advice, since his usual counselors are all men. Australia's second biggest bank, Westpac, has been accused of 23 million breaches of anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing laws. Phil Mercer has the details.
Westpac is likely to be hit with huge fines. The Australian banking giant is facing legal action from regulators who claim it flouted anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing laws. Investigators allege that Westpac allowed institutions from countries, including Iraq, Lebanon, Zimbabwe, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, access into Australia's financial sector without proper checks. This, according to the watchdog, potentially allowed criminals and terrorists to transfer money into or out of Australia. The Australian Transaction Reports and Analysis Centre, or AUSTRAC, the country's financial crime agency, has also alleged that Westpac failed to properly monitor thousands of transactions that could be linked to child exploitation in the Philippines. It's also claimed the bank ignored warnings and for years enabled suspicious payments from convicted child sex offenders. Nicole Rose is AUSTRAC's chief executive.
Westpac failed to carry out appropriate customer due diligence on high-risk transactions to the Philippines and Southeast Asia concerning known financial indicators relating to potential child exploitation risks.
The US-born boss of Westpac said the bank should have done better and has promised to fix the problems. Brian Hartzer says he was disgusted by the revelations, but rejects the claim the bank has not treated the breaches seriously.
We've absolutely not been indifferent on this topic. So I just want to be really, really clear that as far as I'm concerned, at a senior executive level, for the board, for me personally, in no way have we been indifferent on this.
In theory, Westpac could face multi-million dollar fines for each of the breaches, which could add up to a staggering penalty of $328 trillion US. Analysts, though, expect a meaningful, painful, but not catastrophic civil penalty to be handed down by Australia's federal court. Last year, the Commonwealth Bank agreed to pay the biggest fine in Australian corporate history of $476 million for breaches of anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing laws that resulted in vast amounts of cash going to drug traffickers. Earlier this year, a public inquiry exposed widespread wrongdoing in Australia's finance industry. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Brush fires in Australia have spread to the state of Victoria as firefighters struggle to put out hundreds of existing blazes across several states. Reuters' Jason Albano has more.
Bushfires in Australia spread to the state of Victoria on Thursday as firefighters continue to battle hundreds of blazes across several states. Authorities in Victoria issued a code red alert, indicating the worst possible bushfire conditions, saying that the fires would be fast-moving, unpredictable, and likely uncontrollable. It's also the first time that the state issued such an alert in 10 years. Officials have warned some towns in the state that it was already too late to evacuate and that their safest option is to take shelter indoors. Residents of Sydney in the state of New South Wales were urged to keep children indoors as pollution from the smoke engulfed the city for the third straight day at a level five times considered hazardous. The fires, sparked by high temperatures and strong winds, have burnt through 2.5 million acres of bush and farmland and destroyed more than 400 homes. They've also claimed the lives of four people in the process. Years of drought have left bushland susceptible to fire and have been linked by experts to climate change, an issue that's put increasing pressure on Prime Minister Scott Morrison as the fires continue to burn.
And that was Reuters reporter Jason Albano. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, engineer Patrick Dalle, and managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for joining us. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news on our website, as well as with our mobile app, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.